ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley from ABC News Daily, the podcast that brings you one big story affecting your world each weekday in just 15 minutes.
Data centres are not digging anything up. They're not exploiting resources that are owned by the Australian people, but they certainly shouldn't be getting concessional prices for the electricity they use.
Join me for ABC News Daily. Find us on ABC Listen.
If you wanted to paint a doomsday scenario about what China could do to us, they could access all these Chinese electric vehicles in Australia. It's not that many years ago that the best technology and the most potent technology in the world was inside the national security agencies. It was just kept secret. Now, a complete flipping of that paradigm where the most potent technologies are in the hands of private companies.
That must give you nightmares as someone who's worked in national security.
Yeah, it does a little bit.
We're returning this week to one of the big challenges we're all living through, the artificial intelligence revolution. There are so many aspects to this transformation, including the issues of water and power usage by data centres, or the impact on jobs and productivity, Australian culture. We're not dealing with those issues specifically today. Today, I'm keen to look at the potential risks and potential benefits of AI when it comes to national security. Because as the government, defence and private sector firms, big and small, choose which AI platforms to adopt and for what purposes, there is an enormous amount at stake for all of us. For starters, there's the risk of AI models going rogue. Just in the last few weeks, two major platforms, OpenAI and Anthropic, have both admitted their models broke out or bypassed parameters that had been set, launching their own cyber attacks autonomously. It's easy to see how concerned some are about autonomous weapons doing such a thing. Then there is the intensifying competition between the US and China. In recent months, AI models being developed in China have seriously closed the gap on performance when compared to models that are coming out of the US, and they are considerably cheaper too, and in many cases easier for businesses to use. So with two competing AI ecosystems emerging, where does this leave Australia? What should governments, business and even individuals be thinking about here? Well, I'm pleased to say we have a guest today who's watched the rise of AI very closely with Australia's national security in mind. Rachel Noble is the former Director General of the Australian Signals Directorate, which manages Australia's foreign signals intelligence, its cyber security, as well as its offensive cyber operations. I'm David Spears on Ngunnawal Country at Parliament House in Canberra. Welcome to Insiders on Background. Rachel Noble, welcome. It's great to talk to you about all of this and pick your brains on a big aspect of the AI revolution we're living through. So thanks so much for your time.
Well, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
I feel like I should start by asking whether I'm even in the right frame of questions here about AI and its national security implications. There are so many facets to consider. When you think about national security and AI, what's concerning you the most right now?
I guess the number one issue is really that these new frontier models, from what I hear, are all they're cracked up to be. And we've always had a situation in cybersecurity where the defender gets a small advantage and then the adversary works out how to get through the holes, and then the defender plugs the holes and on we go. I think what's happening with frontier AI models is that that game is going to move so much faster at a pace that we have never seen. And I think that's going to lead Australia and probably other countries into a period where we're going to have a greater frequency of serious cyber incidents and a challenge to get our private companies and governments alike to utilise these models, move at speed and continue to protect ourselves from the vulnerabilities. But also, I think shifting to a posture of appreciating that it's a matter of when, not if, and the focus has to be on how quickly we can recover and increasing our resilience for the longer term.
I mean, that's rather sobering. What you're saying, that we are going to see more significant, successful hacks simply because of the pace of advancement here from that hacking technology and the need for defensive capabilities to keep up. but it's about how we respond to those hacks.
Right.
Or how quickly we can shut them down.
That's right. But also how companies and governments are thinking about, well, if I do suffer a cyber incident, what's my backup plan? So where else do I have copies of my data? How can I get my services back up and running? And how quickly can I do that in a sort of posture where it's going to happen?
And how important then, as part of that ability to respond, is AI itself? Because while AI, clearly, the great risk is its ability to hack, to find ways through systems at speed that we haven't witnessed before. It's AI as well that, I guess, has the best capacity to identify weaknesses, holes in systems, and put those walls in place. So just tell us how important that need is to have the best AI models available.
Well, it is going to be that sort of cat and mouse game. Mm. And so we have to, because we know the adversaries are going to have access and probably already do have access to these frontier models, that's an access that we need to have here in Australia. And we can talk about sort of all of the enabling infrastructure and policy guardrails that need to sit around that, which is a big topic of discussion here in Australia. But we need access to those models because we need them to understand our context, our data, our settings in order to, in the first instance, increase our cybersecurity and increase our chance of blocking the adversaries at the same speed as which they're going to be able to get after us. So
that's an interesting point. So we can't just buy something off the shelf and expect tomorrow that it's going to understand how to defend Australia's security interests.
That's exactly it.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's exactly
and,
it.
And when we talk about the need to have those models here and, for want of a better word, understanding Australia, are we just talking about government, and by that I also mean defence, our security agencies, and departments that hold sensitive information, or is it also private sector operators who own critical infrastructure, telcos, power companies, water companies?
Right. I think it's all of that and more. I think we're going to enter a period of competition for businesses being able to offer services at the speed at which people are going to expect, at the quality that people are going to expect. So it's even a matter of not just our national security and our cyber defences, but ultimately in Australia's economic interests. And I think if we can prove that we can provide certainty to the commercial sector about the future of this technology in Australia, certainty about what might be expected of them in terms of standards or guardrails put around it, the sooner we can do that, the more likely we are to increase innovation and investment in Australia. We've got a lot going for us. It's sunny, it's clear, it's dry, we've got a lot of land.
Exactly. And this is where that debate around data centres, I suppose, comes in, because clearly, there's a lot of concern, and this is happening in the US, around the world as well, about these big data centres, energy hungry, water hungry, and so on. The government wants to deal with that by requiring them to look after those water and power issues themselves and use renewables. The trade-off we keep being told is the economic benefit. This is huge investment that will be... there's the national security issue seems to be missing from this debate a bit. Is there a need for Australia to have these data centres to leverage access to the best AI models for our own national security?
Absolutely. So without getting too technical, first of all, you've got to have chips that the processing power that sit within big data centres that can house those chips and the software and hardware that access them, on top of which they then run these big models that are learning and understanding and being able to be given a task and then go away and work out how to execute on that task. So the data centres are sort of like the water that we need to underpin these capabilities. So I think what's going to be really interesting over the next few months as the government thinks about legislation that might put guardrails around these models, but also related to that, the expectation on the underpinning infrastructure like data centres, is the question of sovereignty and from a national security point of view.
So just explain that to us clearly, and the Prime Minister said this to us on Insiders, in fact, at the Labor Party conference a few weeks ago, when I asked him about these national security implications, that they were negotiating to get access to Anthropic's Mythos model, which is, from all I read, you know, the top of the tree, the number one model you want. So what does that mean? Negotiating with Anthropic, saying, what, we will let you build all these data centres, but you need to ensure we have access to this model with its ability to do these things.
I think in the narrowest sense of that, what's important to Australia is if Mythos can really do what it says on the package, then its superpower is it can go out into people's networks and look at the software that they have and identify vulnerabilities in that software.
So it could go to a bank, it could go to a power company, find where the weaknesses are.
You got it. Exactly. And the idea, and those are those weaknesses that bad guys use to get in to hack people's networks. So the game here is for the Australian government with the US government, Anthropic, and important critical infrastructure providers here in Australia to get access to Mythos first, run it over those environments and plug the holes as best we can before what will inevitably happen is that, you know, Anthropic's a commercial company. At some point, it's got to make money. At some point, it's going to commercialize Mythos and release either its current version or a version of it. And I think that's a very interesting and difficult discussion between governments and these big private companies.
Are you across what's going on there? Because it is a little confusing. This is where the Trump administration put some restrictions on who could access this and Anthropic itself. Because we're a Five Eyes partner country, are we going to get access to Mythos? I think the UK has already.
Yeah, I think that's right. Let me put it this way. I've absolute confidence in ASD. You'd expect me to say that, and in Abby Bradshaw's leadership there, because I think they're spearheading this for the Australian government, mainly because they understand the technology better than any other government department or agency, and I have absolute confidence that they will be able to get the access that we need to protect ourselves. And I'm also a big believer in our alliance with the United States, in the institutions that we work with, and that ultimately it is in both our interests, and I'm going to put it in sort of fairly binary terms, that the West can win this game.
That is an interesting frame. Are you worried that the West is at risk of losing this game?
I think at the moment the West has the edge, and so the reason for that is China, I guess, is the other big competitor, particularly in this AI space. The West, and particularly the United States, has actually done a very good job of constraining China's access to AI infrastructure and some of the absolute best, you know, computer chips on which these models run. China's pursuing a very different strategy in light of that, where what they're doing is building their own AI models, which are pretty good from what I understand.
You've probably getting better.
And how they're making them get better is they've made them open to the world. So what happens is developers come along, they grab that model, and then they play with it and improve it and make the improved version open to the world. So they're managing to increase their quality, if you like, through that model. What the West is doing, though, is saying we've got some open models, but the really good ones with the most clever maths at the bottom of them, we're going to keep them to ourselves, and we're going to then work through how we might release those commercially with a different strategy. If you want it, you've got to buy it from them, you've got to buy their infrastructure, and they're going to make money from running it for you and giving you access to it. So we've got two different strategies here, but the core of why the West is ahead is all about the hardware that's sitting underneath.
But those Chinese models, as you say, open source models,
right,
getting better all the time,
right,
obviously cheaper for businesses to access.
That's it. Yeah.
What are the risks here for Australian companies that might be looking at those models?
Right. Well, one thing that I'm absolutely fascinated about, and I couldn't personally verify this because it's coming from China's own artificial intelligence development plan that was only released in Mandarin. So I'm relying on English language sort of translations. But what's really interesting in that development plan is that they state very clearly that all AI model outputs have to have outputs that are consistent with core socialist values. So if you kind of think about that from a Western value setting or even an Australian value setting, I'm not sure that that's something that would make every Australian feel entirely comfortable or anyone in a democratic society. So we've got some sort of interesting sort of value settings and control settings that are sitting over the top of some of this implementation that isn't consistent with our own values.
And does that value setting and control setting, as you put it, suggest some capacity, ability for the Chinese Communist Party or the Chinese government to access sensitive information where these models are being used?
That is the benefit of the open model approach, right? So if you're a developer, you're putting your data in, you're playing with it, it absolutely gives them the potential to harness how it's being used and harness what they've understood about its use and any of the data that's flowing in to the use of those models. So that is one aspect of the risk. I think, interestingly, this sort of core socialist values idea is a self-limiting constraint. So on the other hand, there's an interesting constraint that they may put around the use for themselves and for others.
Which brings me to something you recently said to Peter Harcher in the Sydney Morning Herald about China's ability to plant malicious software in critical infrastructure. You said some of the most concerning recent advisories are telling us that the People's Republic of China has the capability and has been found in Australia pre-positioning on our critical infrastructure. What's going on?
Right. So this is the bit that keeps me awake at night, and it does worry me that sometimes this risk is getting lost in a bigger, sort of noisier conversation. But late last June, about August last year, the Australian Signals Directorate put out an advisory about an actor called Salt Typhoon. And we love to give them these cool names. I sort of wish we wouldn't. They're also known as Ghost Emperor, to give you an idea about sort of the cyber world. But what they said is that this actor, Salt Typhoon, has been observed in Australia. And what they can do, and I'll do this in plain language, they put the equivalent of a piece of dynamite under a bridge. So a little piece of malicious software in critical infrastructure, think our telcos, water, energy, and it sits there and then can later be activated at a time of China's choosing. And what it can do is deny or degrade or disrupt somehow or even totally destroy the proper operating of the network in which it's sitting. And so that means in a sort of extreme example that if they wanted to turn off our energy supply, they could do that at will. And so it's extremely hard to detect, though, because unlike normal espionage, which is world's second oldest profession, you will see traffic going out of your network. At some point, you've got to pull it out to get access to that information. So stuff moves over the network and it might be easier to detect because you can see something going on. How this sort of prepositioning works is you only need to come back and check on that stick of dynamite maybe once or twice a year. You might be checking that the wick hasn't gotten wet or the dynamite's still fresh or whatever. And what they do is use the stolen logins and passwords of legitimate workers. And it's hard for companies to find it because they might sneak in at 2 a.m. and they might have David Spears' login and password. And unless, you know, with the help of ASD and the Five Eyes intelligence and the cooperation of the private company, it's very hard to see if that's unusual behaviour for David Spears.
I mean, the stakes there are incredibly high.
It's
the
nasty
prospect of energy supply, water supply being cut off.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking here about the capability of China to do this.
Right.
Has China done this in Australia?
I think we would know about it
if right.
because it would be observable. And I think this goes to the doctrine of deterrence and denial, which are two really important roles that the Australian Signals Directorate plays, and that the big Red Spice $10 billion investment, which is decided now 7 years ago, so that's, you know, in prehistoric
back when you were there.
Times, yes. Tripling ASD's offensive cyber capability and talking about that publicly and talking about big operations like ASD taking out the 6 Russian cyber criminals that got into Medibank are really important components of that deterrence strategy. So what it's really saying is we have a potent capability and we're willing to use it and we're exercising it, and it's really fun to do that against cyber criminals because it feels good. It's a great message to Aussies that not all cyber crime goes without consequence,
yeah,
but it's a much more important strategic message of deterrence.
Yeah, and are you confident that with that deterrence, Australia has been able to stop this malicious software being planted, or is it possible that some has been?
I think based on ASD's advisory, we have not stopped it being planted. The game here is to stop it being used.
So it's there,
right?
But it's not
activated.
Going to be triggered, you don't think, because of Australia's deterrence?
That's the game, right? And right. So we have to keep strengthening that deterrence, though, because we want to keep the adversary's cost-benefit analysis too costly for them. So their calculation is if we ever crack at Australia through cyberspace, we're not sure if they can't hit us back harder. So maybe we won't start the game. It's a classic deterrence.
Which goes to that intriguing element that I flagged at the start about ASD's role in offensive cyber operations as well. But look, just coming back to the AI debate though, bearing all of that in mind, what should governments, but I guess more specifically the private sector, be thinking about when they're looking at AI models and some of the options from China as well?
Mm-hmm.
And what should ASD be thinking about when, you know, people are going to be adopting models that might carry risks like this?
Yeah, well, I think there's, the government, first of all, is, I think, doing a magnificent thing in drawing the responsibility of this into the Prime Minister's department, and that he himself is taking leadership, because that's what it's going to take for us. I think the challenge for the government now is to move at tech speed, not government speed. And so, you know, government makes policies slowly, deliberately, and once they make it or they pass laws, it's usually pretty good and it stands the test of time. I don't think we have that luxury now, and we've got a lot of voices here in Australia. We've got artists concerned about copyright. We've got big debate around energy and sustainability. We've got unions concerned about the future of work. We've got economic interests, national security interests. And, of course, we've got a lot of pressure from the big tech bros who are, you know, wanting to, you know, offering us big money for that investment. The government's challenge is to put sensible guardrails around
it. Well, the Prime Minister's flagged draft legislation by the end of the year and then present the legislation to Parliament in the new year. Are you saying that's too slow?
I'm saying that we're at the risk of being too slow, but I'm, you know, having been inside government, I'm also sympathetic. It's so hard. And with all of those voices that have to be, you know, consulted and brought in and negotiated with, that's pretty speedy, I think. Mm. But, you know, we've got to get to a conclusion quickly. It's one thing to have draft legislation. How quickly can it be passed?
But specifically on the national security element of all this, and you're right, there's so many things that government will have to work out and balance and get right. But on the national security element, where do you think this should land? Should government be saying, here are AI models that can be used in Australia, and here are models that particularly critical infrastructure owners cannot use?
I think we have to have these models here, and we have to have access to the chips and have data centres that can provide the compute power that those models need. We need these large language models to learn on Australian data in an Australian context, on Australian networks, if we're going to be able to protect ourselves from a national security point of view to the level we will need to, or else, you know, we're at risk of becoming undone from a national security point of view.
But what about the use of these Chinese models?
Yeah.
Should there be any sort of ban on those?
I think the way that I would sort of think about it is twofold, I suppose. One, it's just really important to know or understand just how eye-wateringly expensive these frontier models are. So if you're a business or a government department, what you probably need to do is look really hard at what you want AI to do in your business and how you want it to assist you, and then be able to utilise more conventional models to get you 98% of the way there, and then use your frontier model access to get you the last little bit of the way. And to give you an idea about how expensive all of this is, it's $40,000 just for one chip. These frontier models need up to 100,000 chips.
Wow.
Just so that's kind of what, 4 billion or whatever. And then to train that frontier model on top of that, it's hundreds of millions of dollars to get it to train in your environment. So, and you pay by tokens, which actually is like paying for a service provision, and a token is 4 characters. So every 4 characters that the AI model receives from you is a question. That's one cost for a token. It's cheaper than the 4 characters it sends back to you by way of an answer, which is even more expensive. So this is how these models are sort of commercially structured for their use. So I think to your question about China versus the US versus frontier, I think it goes back to the same basic questions that ASD have been banging on about for years, about, well, what use is it being put to? What are your crown jewels that you most want to protect? What governance, the boring stuff, what governance do you have around its use? What controls?
But I mean, if that's critical infrastructure, the crown jewels, to stop, you know, what we've been talking about happening on energy and water, should there be a clear rule, law around what can and can't be adopted?
I think the expectations on them are already much higher under the Systems of Critical Infrastructure Act, which does go to a lot of those things that I mentioned about, you know, who has access, who's on the board, who can control decisions, what extraterritorial reach do other countries' laws have into Australia, and how can those be managed and controlled? I think we have to look at these models in the same way that we're looking at the risks of all Internet of Things, and where it's coming from and what the supply chains are across the board for us as a nation. And I guess my only bit of advice is we can't get too silly about that, because if a Chinese model can help you and it's cheaper and it's on the fringe, then maybe it's okay to use.
Well, so, yeah, it is. Some of this does get a bit silly. where do you stand on, you know, the idea that buying a Chinese-made electric vehicle is going to be at risk because it'll suddenly be, you know, taken control of at some point? Is that getting a bit far-fetched?
Yeah, well, I think I'll probably give you an annoying answer that you might think that's such a public servant thing to say. But I think how the national security community thinks about this is in sort of frameworks of risk. And how I remember it is CIA, so it's easy to remember.
Yeah, especially in the spy game.
Yeah, exactly. Capability, intent and access. And so I think what we understand about China, and we talked about Salt Typhoon, is that they have the capability and they have the access. The intent part is a tricky, more subjective test. And so if we look at electric vehicles as a sort of case that you've raised, if you wanted to paint a doomsday scenario about, you know, what China could do to us and maybe they could access all these Chinese electric vehicles in Australia and make them all stop or create a big traffic jam blockage or whatever, you have to then think through the question of intent. So how would that necessarily be in China's economic interests? It's one of the most significant exports for China. If they actually acted on that intent, then they would never sell another Chinese vehicle ever. So I think it's hard. These are risk judgments. There isn't simple answers, I don't think, to all of these things.
No, that's interesting. Look, just finally, coming back to where the government's at in approaching particularly the national security elements of AI, you've talked about the need for speed here to get this right, but as quickly as possible. What else would you say the government needs to be doing that perhaps it's not or not hearing about so much publicly anyway when it comes to this?
I think we will need the government to work very hard with the US government to not only get that first access. And what we know from what we hear publicly in the United States is Anthropic, we'll use them as an example, they call it Project Glasswing, which is a project they have to release Mythos to certain companies within the United States. The challenge, I think, for us is to make sure that we get a deal where we can get early access for as many of our critical infrastructure providers as they can possibly allow us, not just a smaller handful, because we need everybody to... We want to start this race with all of our critical infrastructure providers having that advantage before the adversary starts their game.
And that, does that need to happen this year?
Absolutely, absolutely. Right. What we do know is big American companies, it's an amazing country. It's driven by commercial imperatives and money, which is amazing. We do not know at what point Anthropic or OpenAI might actually choose to commercially release these models.
We want to get ahead of that.
We want to get ahead of that. And at the moment, the companies are saying what us national security people would think is the right thing, that they've realised the capability that they're sitting on, that the power of these capabilities, and actually, without using these terms, they have started to think about these frontier models like we thought about weapons, and that we need to be able to understand how they're built and controlled before they're exported.
And when it's a really interesting parallel, because when we talk about weapons, whether it's a particular missile or a F-35, that's a decision for the US administration to make. So is this decision on Mythos, if it is the weapon of the future, is that the decision of Anthropic or Donald Trump?
That's a great question, because that's the huge dilemma.
And is it clear?
I don't think it is clear. Right. And you know, it's not that many years ago that the best technology and the most potent technology in the world was inside the national security agencies. And when it was that potent, it was just kept secret. What we've got is now a complete flipping of that paradigm, where the most potent technologies are in the hands of private companies. And so
That must give you nightmares as someone who's worked in national security.
Yeah, it does a little bit. And I think what we saw in the United States was that the US government, as its appreciation of the potency of Mythos became more apparent, it did the blunt force trauma thing and the right thing that governments do and ban it. So they stopped it and you know, it was really challenging for Australians who woke up one morning and couldn't access Fable, which is OpenAI's model, because the government said, stop, we need to talk about this. And I think that's a difficult policy dilemma, but one that the Australian government must be a part of that conversation too.
Talking to both Anthropic and the Trump administration about getting that early access.
Exactly.
Well, Rachel Noble, I'm not sure if I feel any more relaxed about
sorry,
where this is all heading, but I do feel a lot more informed. So thank you for helping us all understand this a little bit. I really appreciate your time.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And we'll be back Sunday morning for Insiders, looking at what's happened this week and our 25th anniversary of Insiders as well. So looking forward to that little celebration. PK will be back in the podcast feed on Monday, and we'll return with Insiders on Background at the end of the week. Bye for now.
You're making us all feel very excited about being here.